It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one, and also tell your friends about it. It's been a great month for us, but I always welcome more listeners and more feedback, which you can send to me at ben@thefederalist.com. Today, we have a conversation with two different people who give us their takes on what's going on in Canada from the perspective of both a political pundit and from someone who is actually on the ground as part of the so-called Freedom Convoy, which has been raising all manner of Canadian political hay, given the fact that they've been pushing back against the various mandates and requirements installed under the regime of Justin Trudeau. First, we have a conversation with Michael Tobe. He is a columnist for Troy Media, a contributor to the National Post and the Washington Times, and was a speechwriter for former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, a conservative. And then we have a conversation with Harold Junker, who is one of the truckers who is actually participated in that convoy. He called us from a very active scene that he was participating in terms of protest against Prime Minister Trudeau's policies, with a number of different takes, I think, that are valuable from the perspective of someone who actually made the decision to go out into the streets and take up this protest. A conversation with Michael Tobe, followed by a conversation with Harold Junker. I hope that you will find both to be enlightening.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today to discuss a topic that has surprisingly taken over the conversation, not just in Canada, but around the world. You've obviously been paying attention to the pushback on so many different policy fronts in Canada for quite a while, but were you surprised to see the nature of the response, both from the government and from the media, that this convoy protest in particular resulted in?
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Ben. I don't think any Canadian, no matter their political stripe, would have assumed that after 3 weeks, we would still be discussing this Freedom Convoy. It's quite shocking. But when you think about it, based on the way it started, and obviously many American media organizations, including Fox News, have covered it, I think it's sort of understandable why, when you look at it. You know, it started off very briefly on January the 15th, when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his Liberal government decided to change the measures or the restrictions that had not occurred or not existed in terms of mandated vaccines for truckers and other essential workers. Before that time, they had been exempt from that mandatory vaccination rule, but they switched it. And this frustrated a lot of Canadians, as I'm sure you've seen and others have seen, because of the trucker's importance in our society. And you and I, as you know, I as a Canadian, you as an American, know that cross-border trade and cross-border trucking are extremely important to our mutual economies, or for the North American economy. And the fact that the truckers were being targeted, when the Canadian Trucking Alliance actually announced that roughly, in their estimate, 85% of all truckers were already fully vaccinated at this point, made the whole thing rather shocking and made a lot of Canadians wonder why they were isolating truckers based on their importance in our country. So when the convoy started, which was a series of smaller convoys that started in provinces like BC and Alberta, then linked in with Ontario, Quebec, and eventually all 10 provinces had some representation, a larger convoy that went to the nation's capital in Ottawa and then led to the protest between starting around January 29th that now I think a lot of people are now aware of. I think what became very interesting is you saw two sides to the story. One side being that, you know, that people who supported the basic principles of the Freedom Convoy, which were, as the title states, the enhancement or increasement of individual rights and freedoms, but at the same time also opposing things like a mandatory vaccination or some of the government restrictions and measures that existed during the various lockdown periods we've experienced during COVID-19. Those basic ideas or tenets were supported by many Canadians, no matter whether they were right-leaning like me, left-leaning, or had no wing whatsoever. But on the flip side, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, is that some of the news coverage then also focused away from that, which is obviously extremely important, and I think represents the basic principle of the Freedom Convoy, which was a peaceful protest overall, to some of the screwballs, shall we say, and other little issues that occurred up where we saw a swastika, a Confederate flag being flown by people. We saw the desecration of various statues, including the National War Monument and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and a statue of Terry Fox, who's a national hero here. While those matters, you know, were tidied up and didn't become too big an issue, I think what happened was, as the weeks went along, the basic principles that a lot of Canadians believed in, and certainly a lot of conservatives believed in, started to change when the blockades at places like the Ambassador Bridge in Windsor and two other quadrants, both in Alberta and BC, which obviously crossings with the United States, started to become a major issue and an economic concern for a lot of conservatives, which obviously you and I and others are motivated by.
So to give our listeners, who are mostly obviously American-based, some sure. context for this moment politically, tell me a little bit about the reaction overall to Prime Minister Trudeau's leadership during this, but also about kind of the nature of Canadian governmental power. How much power is actually invested in him in Ottawa or across the country in kind of the confederacy of regions that have their own authorities, just so that they can understand a little bit about the power dynamic that's going on.
No, certainly. I'll unpack it for you as I've unpacked it for places like the Wall Street Journal, the Spectator magazine in the UK, and others who obviously know a little bit about it, but don't quite understand all the little particulars that are involved with it. Very briefly, Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, who many conservatives like myself have been critiquing for his weak, ineffective leadership since he was first elected prime minister in 2015, when he defeated my old friend and boss, Stephen Harper, in that federal election. We've noticed since the very beginning, and a lot of us were not caught off guard by this, that he was really not suitable for the job. Unlike his late father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who most conservatives didn't care for, but at least respected for his intelligence, his political savvy, his ability to use strategic comms and other things, Justin Trudeau is not like his father. And we noticed that from the very start, he just did not know how to handle issues. And during the Freedom Convoy protests, this has been heightened even more to the point that, yes, Mr. Trudeau has been elected three times, albeit with two minority governments in 2019 and 2021, respectively. But what they noticed was, one, that Justin Trudeau did not involve himself with the Freedom Convoy in the sense that neither he nor any senior Liberal ministers or cabinet ministers actually went to meet with any of the organizers or the many protesters who had come from coast to coast to coast in this country and were from all walks of life. The inability to build a bridge or some sort of at least some alignment of communications with the people who were out there protesting for reasons that obviously they believed were valid, and quite a lot of Canadians did too, just showed unfortunately how much Justin Trudeau has changed over the years. Trudeau used to be someone who would build bridges with others. He would occasionally, before he became prime minister, he would meet with other conservatives and try to speak with them, break bread, or align with them. He even met with Quebec separatists, Ben, which is kind of astonishing. But that man, Justin Trudeau of, let's say, 2015, is not the Justin Trudeau of 2022. Now, instead, he prefers to call the protesters who are out there a quote-unquote fringe minority, and he basically prefers to ostracize them rather than bring them into the conversation or the table. No one expected Trudeau or his ministers to meet with the organizers and agree to all their demands and, you know, come up with some sort of, you know, conclusion that made sense for both sides. But they expected there to be some conversation, because if there isn't, you're just going to create more tension, more aggravation, more frustration. And that's what we've seen with the truckers and protesters who are still there in Ottawa as 3 weeks have just passed. So his leadership has been ineffective during this time. And when he introduced the Emergencies Act, which, you know, is basically a principle where the country declares a national emergency based on what Parliament deems something that other levels of government, police forces, and others cannot handle properly within the constitutional jurisdictions that we have in this country, that's when it also became worse, because now the Emergencies Act, which we can get a little bit into, has enforced or allowed the police and other forces to basically, I wouldn't say strong arm, but have more ability to push back, get rid of the protesters, arrest them. Even though, as I've said, the Freedom Convoy, by and large, has been a peaceful protest overall. So I think that Trudeau's leadership through this whole thing, and obviously I'm a conservative, so I have my own position on it, I think it's been terrible, and has actually just proved that everything I was frustrated by and other conservatives were frustrated by or have been for more than 6 years was justified in just 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. He laid that out in, I think, a real obvious display in his response to being quoted, having Melissa Lantzman, the conservative MP, quote his own words to him in that regard the other day. The dismissive attitude that he had in response to that incident was one that I feel like, you know, it just, it was a politician who seemed that seemed frustrated with an intransigent people and willing to just smear at will, something which is obviously hardly unique to the role of politics, but it's something that typically a lot of politicians tend to do that when they're losing the argument and they know it and they become frustrated with it. Just in terms of your perspective, do you believe that that's what's happening here? That the convoy, as much as they, you know, are one that has created some difficulties for Canada in recent weeks, and we'll talk about that when it comes to the economic side of things, that Trudeau is basically frustrated by a situation where he felt like he was losing the argument. And so the smear of all of these people who disagree with him as being racists or xenophobes or swastika waivers was something he felt comfortable doing.
Exactly. And I think you encapsulated it quite well. In fact, the Melissa Lantzman episode encapsulated it perfectly. I've known Melissa for many years. I have a lot of time for her. She's an extremely intelligent politico. She has worked within the Conservative Party for many years in war rooms and for others. She was active within the Harper governments around the same time I was there. This is a person who is, you know, and in many ways is emblematic of the sort of new style of conservatism we're seeing, not just in this country, but in general. You know, Melissa is a Jewish female and gay MP. Now, that combination, I think we both know, Ben, years ago, would not have existed at all. It would not even be something that would have even been in the forefront of thought. But it's interesting now that someone like that comes forward. And again, Melissa is also, her grandparents are Holocaust survivors. And when she came out and criticized the Prime Minister during a procedure of the House of Commons, or just a discussion of the House of Commons, as you would expect the opposition to do or an opposition MP to do, the first line that Justin Trudeau came back with, as he said that, you know, and I'm just paraphrasing a little bit, you know, does the Conservative Party or people like Melissa Lantzman want to stand with people who wave swastikas? I mean, yes, it's political gamesmanship, we know that, but it was an offensive comment to people, whether they are Jewish or not Jewish. And I was born Jewish. I left the faith close to 40 years ago, Ben, and even I found it insulting. It was just a horrifying comment to make. And when Melissa asked the Prime Minister, and she was one of two MPs in the Conservative Party who did, when Melissa asked him to apologize on behalf of her, of course, and on behalf of all members of the House of Commons, what do you think the Prime Minister did? He walked out of the House of Commons. That's how he handled it. So yes, he's in a long-winded fashion, he has lost control of this discussion. He has lost control of the narrative. He has lost control of the story. And he's just shown, unfortunately, how ineffective he is as a leader, that he couldn't even stand the heat. So he left the kitchen, that being the House of Commons.
So talk to me about the national emergency side of this. Here in the various states, what we've seen is a lot of governors assert emergency powers that enabled them to do things that I think a lot of people didn't necessarily believe any politician had the ability to do, sometimes quite laughably. And in many instances, you had situations where these governors were just rubber stamping continued emergency invocations in order to maintain those powers. I do think, looking back, perhaps the most laughable moment was when Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer prevented the ability of people to purchase seeds and lawn goods, which was just a particular.
I was flabbergasted too. So don't worry.
And so I think that that's been something where a lot of Americans have come out of this or are coming out of this with their eyes open to, hey, you know, the governors have a lot of emergency powers, quote unquote, that don't necessarily seem to depend on an actual emergency that allow them to do basically everything without having to run it through approvals. And in Canada, this conversation is something that is definitely receiving notice among conservatives in America because of the exercised powers here. And we'll get into kind of the financial ramifications potentially of that for those who are involved in this convoy. This is an Emergency Powers Act, or a version of it, I should say, that has not been invoked before, has it? And what is it actually built for? And is it actually built for moments like this?
Yeah, I mean, not obviously to talk too much inside baseball, but basically this Emergencies Act has never been enacted before. This is the first time it's ever been invoked in this country. Now, the Emergencies Act in 1988, and there's a reason why I'm bringing it up, replaced something called the War Measures Act. The War Measures Act was something that, yes, was used for war, and I'll explain a little further, but the only person who used it, or the only prime minister who used it during peacetime, was ironically Justin Trudeau's father, who I mentioned before, Pierre Trudeau. Now, the War Measures Act was brought forward because of what was called the FLQ crisis in October 1970, which was involved the kidnapping of a diplomat, and the fact that the FLQ, which is basically was called the Liberation Front of Quebec and no longer exists, was seen as a terrorist, or if you'd like, a quasi-terrorist organization. So even if you didn't like what Pierre Trudeau did in 1970, at least you can see the rationale of why he did it. Was there a better way to handle it? Possibly, but at least it made sense because it was a horrifying act to happen, not just in Canada, it'd be horrifying for any country. In the case of the Emergencies Act, as I've said, the fact that the Freedom Convoy was a mostly peaceful protest, and we did not see anything, say, akin to what the elder Trudeau dealt with when he invoked the War Measures Act in 1970, it has made a lot of conservatives, not just in this country, but elsewhere, wonder, and you correctly point out many of the governors who've done similar measures. Even Ontario Premier Doug Ford, who's a conservative in this country, had invoked a state of emergency provincially. So there have been issues like this that have happened. But the Emergencies Act is sort of seen as something that is unnecessary to have been done because there just wasn't anything that warranted it. Yes, there is obviously frustration that truckers have stayed on the roads, have blocked, you know, there have been blockades at crossings and other things. But whenever police or other forces went through to try to bring it down, as they did in the Ambassador Bridge in Windsor, Ontario, they found that overall, that if there was enough commonality, if there was a proper amount of discussion, if fair warning was given, it seemed to end rather peacefully. Now, there's things obviously going on in Ottawa right now, and it's sort of in the early stages, so we'll see how it goes. But I think what unfortunately has happened is the Emergencies Act is seen as a massive overreach of government or the hands of government in issues that they don't necessarily need to be a part of. You know, the hope had been that local police or the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or other forces would have been able to dissolve the crowd, find a way to have a peaceful resolution, and everyone would eventually go home. I agree that it's not come to that point, but to go that far, to use the Emergencies Act, when you consider that this is a prime minister who prefers to take surfing trips to Tofino and not be part of the difficult decisions that we see in this country. This is not a leader, and this has, again, nothing to do with my conservative bent. This is not a leader who has been effective. We've had liberal prime ministers in the past, including Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, who I would never voted for, and I didn't obviously support, but I never looked at them and said, they're not leaders. They couldn't handle things during a crisis. They may not come up with a resolution that I believe in, but at least it'll be something that people would look back on, say, historically, okay, it makes some sense. This is just a massive overreach, was completely unnecessary, and has set a horrendous precedent going forward, not just for this government, for other governments and how they handle whatever they deem to be in a national emergency. And even though Parliament has to consent on what a national emergency is, which is different than the War Measures Act I mentioned earlier, it still does not seem justified. And I think that has thrown off a lot of Canadians. And while there are certainly Canadians who believe in what Mr. Trudeau has done, I wonder still with those that polling, and we've seen sort of a bare majority that seem to be supportive of it, you wonder if they're actually supportive of it based on what they understand the Emergencies Act to be, or the frustration over what they see with the blockade. And briefly, as you said, economically, it's disastrous, those sorts of things, because when cross-border trade between, just say, Canada and the US is hurt, that obviously hurts families. It hurts individuals as well, because we can't get the goods and services that we've needed during this unfortunate pandemic to survive on a daily basis. So the economic repercussions obviously frustrated a lot of people. So I wonder if some of the polling data we've seen from companies like Maru and others, if that has also been incumbent on why the numbers are what they are.
Tell me about the financial side of this. There was a significant effort a fundraising effort designed to allow supporters of what the convoy stood for to throw some money in their direction. That resulted in a crackdown by GoFundMe that that received a lot of attention, particularly because people here in America are very attuned to not just conservatives, are attuned to the actions of big tech in recent years. But then there was also the announcements as in following on the national emergencies invocation that people could expect to see financial ramifications if they were participants in this convoy. Right. Talk to me about what the threats are and were what the reaction has been to the government basically saying, if you participate in this, we're going to treat you like a criminal or a terrorist, and we have the ability to seize your property.
Yeah, no, you're right to seize on that. I agree with you. Basically, the GoFundMe campaign was started at the very beginning of the Freedom Convoy. The goal was to reach about 7 million, which a lot of people would have said at the very start seemed illogical or a very high estimate. But if you want to go for the moon, that makes sense. The irony is, within about a week and a half, they had not only reached it, Ben, they had surpassed it. So they kept moving it along, and eventually the limit got to about 10 million Canadian, and that was surpassed as well. But what has happened during that time, and again, the Freedom Convoy organizers made a mistake in one sense. They didn't actually state where the money was going to go to. Now, in fairness, they may not have known. They probably didn't realize they're going to raise that much. But on the other hand, they needed to also have a plan of action to prevent something like this from happening. As of right now, the GoFundMe campaign, along with a number of others, are all frozen at this point until the organizers determine or deem where this money is eventually going to go, whether it's going to go to form a party, for a bigger movement, for whatever. The other problem as well, and we saw this when the Emergencies Act was announced, was that Minister of Finance Chrystia Freeland also stated that Canadians' bank accounts for people who had donated money to the Freedom Convoy in a variety of ways were also going to be either accounted for by the banks, or they were going to be frozen themselves so that people could potentially ask them questions. Why did they actually do this? We live in a democracy. Now, our democracy is different than your democracy, Ben, but we do live in a democracy that, in theory, believes heavily in the right to democracy, freedom, and liberty. You know, maybe I champion and others champion more than other Canadians, but at the same time, that's always the principle that we followed. It is astonishing to me that this was done, And while the Liberal government may just feel that, you know, in the matter of financial intelligence or FinTrack, which is what they're using, that they're actually trying to do something good, what they've actually done is they've opened up average Canadians who made, in some cases, very small donations to an enormous amount of state interference that I don't think they ever assumed. It's the same for people who immigrated to this country to escape different types of tyranny, you know, more likely communist tyranny as of late. There are people now looking at it saying, my God, this is similar to what I saw in the Eastern Bloc decades ago. And while that may sound like a bit of an exaggeration, because obviously we know that the Emergencies Act and what they're doing financially is temporary and will obviously be removed, we can safely say that, although we don't know when, much like the Emergencies Act, this is a terrible precedent to set when you know that even your money or your donations can now be monitored. This is the biggest element of Big Brother I've ever seen in my lifetime in this country. And so help me, I really hope that they're able to curtail it and contain it going forward. Because if not, this is a terrible path for Canada to follow, as it would be a terrible path for the United States to follow, for parts of Europe, Asia, Africa, no matter where it is. That is not what we want to see. If we cherish democracy, if we cherish liberty, if we cherish freedom, this is not the route we want to take.
I want to ask you about the end game for this, but before I do, I'm curious about one more aspect. In America, one of the things that has happened in the past couple of years is that there are a number of people who've become essentially cultural signifiers, mm-hmm. Based on their behavior online, whether their influence comes from their celebrity or their cultural prominence. You know, what they have to say kind of radiates and defines things. For instance, you see the latest conflagrations about Joe Rogan, which received, you know, you had celebrities basically picking sides, in the fight, and that type of thing. There are lots of very prominent, you know, Canadians who've become celebrities in Hollywood and elsewhere. Have they been taking sides when it comes to the truckers? Have they been asked to comment on that type of thing? Have there been cultural leaders who have really staked themselves out as being pro one side or the other during this time? And if so, what have been the responses to it?
Well, there have been some people like Dr. Jordan Peterson, who many of your listeners would be familiar with, who actually mm-hmm. did come out and supported the truckers or the Freedom Convoy. There have been some instances where I wouldn't say necessarily Hollywood types, but people have spoken out against it who have some preeminence in this country. I would say, though, that unlike the Joe Rogan Spotify issue, which you correctly pointed out to, we're not seeing, well, ex-Canadians like Neil Young speaking out on a regular basis. but certainly, I think it's fair to say that talking heads like myself have obviously spoken. I don't know how much significance we have, but certainly we're a part of it. There have been ex-politicians, there have been ex-prime ministers who've made small comments or just expressed the fact that they're discouraged or frustrated by what they see, that this is not the Canada that they know. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the celebrity status, I think it's more of a phenomenon in fairness in your country and elsewhere than it is here. But
isn't
certainly,
that, but can I interject? Isn't that interesting? You know, it's sort of like Ryan Reynolds is more pressure to take positions on things that happen in America than he does in his home country, that type of thing.
I concur with you. You're right. And I'm sure if he were here, he'd probably say the same thing. But but I've never met him. I can't speak for him. But
well, you know, when he joins, you know, this podcast, inevitably in the future, I'll be sure to ask him about that. So, Michael, let's go out on this. Okay. What's the end game for how this whole protest is going to play out? Mm. You can't sustain these types of movements forever. Everybody knows that. Yeah. And you know, the leaders who are opposed to them, you know, often get stuck in this waiting game where they don't want to do anything to restart something that might be dying out on its own. But they also don't want to be perceived as weak by lack of response. It seems to me from afar that the response from Trudeau, particularly this National Emergencies Act, is something that risks being, you know, giving this new life in terms of making a lot more people sympathetic and suggesting that, you know, he is overusing his power or using it inappropriately, that he's not someone who even has the capacity after this to bring the nation together. Right. But that's from afar. So what is your take on the way that this is going to wind down?
No, fair comment. It's always a mug's game to get involved in this, especially when it's not quite over yet. But it is something that obviously, and I'm not the only one, there's many of us who are starting to wonder what Canada will look like once the dust is settled and everything has been finished off. You know, one thing that has been interesting to watch, and again, it's a lot of conservatives at the beginning were obviously quite supportive of the Freedom Convoy, basically, as I said earlier during this discussion. But as things started to emerge, like economic blockades and other things, it didn't mean that they were necessarily opposed to the basic principles of the convoy, but they were a little less enthusiastic in terms of their support. Interim Conservative leader Candace Bergen basically also said that she felt that the blockades, you know, should come to an end and it's time for a peaceful resolution. Some people said, well, that's conservatives talking out of both sides of their mouths, but not necessarily, because you can believe in one part of it and not the other. You can see the benefits to, you know, the basic freedoms and liberties that we have in this country versus hurting people in their pocketbooks. I mean, they are two very different things. So you can talk about it in the same position. But where Canada goes from here is a fascinating thing. One is hoping that, much like the War Measures Act of 1970, that the Emergencies Act of 2022 just becomes a footnote in history and that Canada is able to move on in some fashion. The problem is that we've seen is that the Freedom Convoy, you know, the good parts of it will obviously live on. And I think that will encourage a lot of people who want to see more freedom in their lives and want to get rid of a lot of the restrictions from, you know, during this pandemic that they faced. Many of them are hoping that whatever the new normal becomes, or whatever normal is at some point, that this little 3-week period is going to lead to something on that level. The fear or the concern is that the issues behind the Emergency Act and invoking it, and the fact that the state or the government has really overextended its reach, even for a short period of time, that's not something that I would hope most Canadians would want to see going forward. Now, the opposition parties, be it the Conservatives or the left-leaning NDP, Bloc Québécois, Green Party, etc., they can obviously use this to their advantage in the House of Commons and talk about the fact that, and even though obviously the NDP, for example, who are socialist-leaning, actually supported the Emergencies Act being passed, Mr. Trudeau, having a minority government, needed one of the other parties to go with him that had some sizable amount of MPs. I think that a lot of them will then turn around or turn tail and be a bit more critical and say that, well, you know, we had to do it because we had no choice, but at the same time, it was a terrible move. And if Mr. Trudeau and his Liberal ministers had spoken with the protesters, the organizers to begin with, we wouldn't have reached this point. So politically, there'll be some advantages for that. The Conservatives will obviously use it to their advantage too. But the end result is, in the end game, and this is the only part that's dangling, is if some of those bad measures don't just necessarily leave a bad taste in their mouths, but permeate or continue for days, weeks, months, years to come, that's going to be a terrible precedent for this country. It's going to be a horrible thing for us to go moving forward. It will frustrate people in terms of how they consider or look at authority figures, from government to the police, to the way legislation is brought forward, to whether their own freedoms are ever going to be encumbered as time goes along. And that could unfortunately have a bad lasting effect. Now, I'm a realist by nature. My hope is that these things will just be short-lived and we move forward, because, as you know, the march of history never ends and we always obviously have to look for the next thing. And the news cycle will obviously move to the next issue. But unfortunately, I think that just as a focus theme for 3 weeks, although some good did come out of it in terms of what was discussed and many of the issues being discussed, some of the bad aspects, and there were some bad aspects, it's a question of how long they last and how long they continue. My hope simply, Ben, is that it's a short-lived period and we move forward.
Michael Tobe, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
My pleasure. Take care.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this.
So, Harold, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I wanted to get some perspective from folks on the ground as opposed to just the pundit class when it comes to what you're trying to do in Canada. So tell me what motivates you and what you're trying to get out of this demonstration of protest.
What we're trying to get out of this protest is the fact that mandates and lockdowns have been harmful for society for a lot of years, for 2 years now. And we need to move on to regain our freedom, to enjoy the freedom that has been taken away. And yeah, it's time to have the government realize that nothing has worked to stop the spread of COVID. Yes, it's been harmful, but the lockdowns and the mandates have been bad for society. When they go, we will go.
Mm-hmm. Harold, the pushback that your effort has received has extended to the highest ranks of power in Canada. When you hear these elites, these powerful elites, talk about you and your friends and allies in this effort, what do you hear them saying, and what are they getting wrong about you?
What they're getting wrong about us is that we are not a bunch of racist, bigot people. We are not a bunch of people that are acting as terrorists. We are not a bunch of people that are flying the Confederate flag or the swastika. It's not even here. We never see it. Our prime minister and the media here in Canada that's working for him to make us look like a bunch of criminals are spreading lies that has just given us more and more resolve to stay on the line.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we see here in America, it's been a trope of media coverage over the past decade, is that whenever there's protests that are peaceful and come from a perspective that the media doesn't particularly like, they will find the craziest person in the crowd and highlight them. And the flip side is that whenever there's a protest that the media does like, there's no amount of damage or violence that they can do that won't be reported as kind of mostly peaceful. Is this the experience that you've been having there in Canada?
It's very frustrating when you see the news here from your own country and see that, you know, the vets stepped up and the monument of the unknown soldier was supposedly desecrated by a young lady that was dancing on it, and she didn't even know and understand. So the RCMP, the veterans who seen that video, were angered enough that they came and they said, that poor girl didn't understand what she was doing, because normally there is somebody there explaining to people what it is. Mm-hmm. And so they came, they stepped up and they said, we will stand around this monument and explain to people what it is. The media twisted it into something that wasn't there. You've seen pictures of the Terry Fox monument with a rainbow sign on it, with the media being so proud that this flag is on this young man's monument when he didn't even stand for that 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. 30 years ago when that happened, right? And that was okay. We can put the rainbow flag. When a truck driver puts flowers on that monument and somebody hangs the Canadian flag on a Canadian hero's monument, they attack us and say we are desecrating that. Mm-hmm. Like, really, it's so sad what our media is doing.
I wanted to ask you about the practical ways that you've approached this act of protest. There are lots of people who are willing to go out for a single day, march around, carry some things, wave some flags, yell through some bullhorns and the like, but then they go home. How have the people involved in this act of protest prepared and built up, you know, the resources necessary in order to continue it. How are you getting food? How are you getting supplies? How are you getting your resources?
We are getting all that we need and more because of the Canadian people and the American people sending us our supplies in one form of another. And it's been humbling how, you know, the government says we're not allowed to carry fuel to the trucks. Well, that's actually in Canada an illegal act because fuel is our source of heat. They are breaking a law that is in place to ensure people stay warm in Canada. So they tried to stop us from getting our fuel. It didn't work because Canadians, residents of the city, stepped up and kept bringing it. And when it comes to food, like I've been saying to so many other media people, I'm actually eating healthier and better because of what people have donated to support us. Like when I'm on the road, you're always in a hurry. So
of course.
And so I'm getting V8 every morning because it's unbelievable. It's beautiful.
The Harold, the reaction that you saw to the invocation of emergency powers by the Prime Minister and by the government, I'm curious about what people were saying about that. If it came as a shock to you that they would do such a thing, and what's more, that it was immediately followed by these threats that have received a ton of attention here in America about the seizure of bank accounts, of property, of trucks, etc., for those who participate. That's something that has a lot of I'm sure Canadians worried, but Americans worried as well about the breadth of what emergency powers can truly mean. Are you surprised that they invoked it, and what was their reaction among you and your friends when they learned that was happening?
There was some people that kind of panicked, got concerned. A perfect little example of this would be everybody in the world seems to be able to find my cell number, except for the police. They actually didn't have the courage to call my cell phone. They call my business and try to make my dispatcher, who's holding the line there, keeping our business going. They call her, trying to get her to panic. And I, like, you have to call the police. I'm like, no, I don't. I'm going for a nap. If they want to call me, they know where I am. Right? You found my phone number, but the police can't seem to find it. Right? So that's what they're doing. It's all smoke and mirrors to get the Canadian people to panic, to get afraid to come up here to have a beautiful family day weekend. Because on Monday is our family day holiday, and they don't want another party to happen. Mm-hmm. So this is what they're doing to try to stop it. But it's not going to stop because We're resolved to stay here. Yes, there's some guys that have to leave. And that's not because they don't want to stay, but that's because of their family being attacked at home by their neighbors that disagree with this. And they're putting a lot of pressure on them. And that's understandable, right? Mm-hmm. You can't have everybody agree with you. But when you see the amount of people here every weekend, when you saw the support right from the beginning when I signed up, and the people on the bridge, it gave me that resolve that, yes, I know I am doing the right thing.
So. Harold, great things have small beginnings. I'm curious what the trigger moment was for you that made you decide to do what you've been doing over the past several weeks. There's always a moment that comes when someone has to make that determination that it's not just that they're going to express their unhappiness on social media or donate to somebody else to do something, but they have to do something themselves. What was that moment for you?
Sorry, I missed that question because there was a young lady just on our step saying she loves me, loves us. So and you could see in her face that it was genuine joy and love, like that. So that last question I missed, sorry.
No, that's okay. It almost serves as an answer, which is that I said, what was the trigger moment for you where you knew that you had to do something yourself as opposed to just standing around and hoping that other people would do things to make yourselves heard? Was there one thing or a series of things that happened for you that made you know that you would have to do something as opposed to, you know, just making your voice heard online or giving your support to someone else?
I think already way back when I went to, like you mentioned it earlier too, the protests that are have been happening on the streets, and the joy, Uncle John honks the horn, and the love that's been shared. But right, like in any other protest, they have to go home because you're out on the street walking with 12,000, 20,000 people, but they all have to go home. Well, that's what really made me realize that I can go to this protest. I can live in my truck because I have a bunk. I have a little bunk heater that only uses a cup of fuel a day, a night to keep warm. And I'm used to living in this thing for long periods of time. So that's when I really realized that this one is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Do you, how do you pass the time, or how do your colleagues pass the time? Because you are doing an act of protest, but at a certain point, you know, do you turn to your phones for entertainment? What do you do to sort of keep yourself from boredom and the like? Or do you have some tricks that you've learned over the years as a trucker?
Yeah, you have learned some tricks over the years, but I know personally myself, I have not even had time to listen to any of my interviews, watch them online or anything like that. It's like, but I know the drivers too here, we're signing up for a hockey tournament because we're the new kids on the block. Looking forward to that. And hopefully I don't hurt my back too much, but it's been a few years since I've been running around, but I'm walking so much that I've lost weight actually in the last 2 weeks. And the drivers are all keeping themselves busy by having the supporters come and knock on the door. Since this interview started, I've gotten 2 letters from people, and and it's unbelievable. I don't even know what's in there yet, but looking forward to seeing what this young lady has to say. She was kind of almost in tears, Uncle John? And that's what you're seeing. Yeah.
Well,
they're so happy that we're here and begging us not to leave.
Well, Harold, I'll let you go with this question so that you can see what's in those letters. What message would you send to those people who want to support you in this effort, who, you know, may have questions about the best way to do that, especially in the wake of that GoFundMe crackdown that received so much attention here? And people being, you know, nervous a little bit that government bureaucrats or big tech are going to stand in the way of them giving to support your effort.
I think what a lot of people need to start doing is reaching out to their banks, especially up here in Canada, and telling them that if you freeze the bank accounts of truck drivers, we're going to pull our money and go somewhere else and do our business somewhere else. And I think what corporations need to hear is that, yeah, we don't want to support anybody that's supporting the tyranny that's going on in this world. We want to enjoy our freedom. So corporations need to hear from their customers that we're all frustrated, and we would love it if, instead of the Ford company complaining that our bridges got shut down, that they say to the government, you know what, these mandates don't work. Look at the science. And governments, stop this. It's actually harming their business more than the bridges being shut down for the few days.
All right, Harold, I'll let you go and look at those letters. And I wish you best of luck and stay warm. And good luck with the hockey tournament.
Yep. And and one more thing too.
Sure.
Prayers. Yeah. Prayers are answered in ways we never know. And they're powerful. Yes.
That's definitely true, Harold, in my own experience as well. Thank you so much, Harold, for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for reaching out.
So it's always a fool's game to go down the road of suggesting that a State of the Union response is ever going to make or break a political career. It certainly has hurt several people who've participated in such efforts. And there are a lot of folks who've gone down that road and ultimately had their political careers at least short-circuited or briefly end because of how poorly they may have performed in the context of the State of the Union response. I do think that there's an interesting opportunity, though, for Republicans in this year, which really harkens back to the response that came forward with in 2010, when you had a newly elected governor in Virginia, in Bob McDonnell, who really was kind of a precursor to the Tea Party wave that you would experience in 2010. Since this year looks like it's going to be headed in the same direction politically, I think that there's an opportunity here for Republicans to lean into the moment, to recognize that they don't need to think about presidential politics before they think about congressional politics. And I think that they should take up the opportunity that they have in the person of Lieutenant Governor Winsome Sears, a veteran, someone who has had an incredible life story of her own right, and certainly represents the kind of pushback, parent-driven, that is happening across the country, even in readouts as politically left as San Francisco. Parents are fed up with what teachers' unions are offering them and with what is being brought to bear by Democrat politicians who are beholden to those unions. That's something that obviously had a huge impact in Virginia. And despite the slings and arrows of the corrupt media that called Glenn Youngkin and his slate of fellow candidates racist over and over every day, they ultimately prevailed and did so in a state that, frankly, as someone who's lived here for the bulk of my life, I would argue is very blue in lots of ways. Winsome Sears, I think, would be a great person to choose to have this response, because I think that she could, as an accomplished speaker and someone who not everybody in the political scene is really aware of, be a fresh new face for Republicans to put forward in opposition to the Joe Biden agenda and to lay bare all of the different gaps and failures that it has shown itself to have in his first year in office. Winsome Sears, Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, would be a great choice. I hope that the powers that be within the GOP consider her as an opportunity to, again, make the case to parents across this country that the only way to have a path forward toward quality education and away from the racial games of CRT or the union beholden backwards plans of mandatory masking and vaccination for our children is to take a different path, to make a choice that breaks away from the power that these unions have held over our public schools for far too long. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.